Welcome in to another episode of Home Field Advantage. Hope you're all having a great week wherever you may be across our great country or our great land. My name is Will Highland. It is February 26th, 2024, and this is my first episode in a long time, so I'm going to dust off the cobwebs as best I can for you all today. I was on vacation last week. It was a great time. I'll get to that later. But I hope you had a chance to listen to the re-air we did last week of our 2022 interview with Chris Laval. That was a great conversation about 14 months ago. And I hope you have a chance to go back and listen to it if you haven't already. Talked a lot of baseball, talked a lot of sports in general, and we had a great time back then. And so that's why I want to share it during my off week. As for today, it's going to be pretty quick. I have a few travel observations I want to point out. Those of you who know me, I am a homebody. I don't get out often. But when I do, I try and jot down some things that stick out to me. I also want to talk about the Dynasty documentary. That's something that I was really excited for. And there's been four episodes that have come out the last two Fridays. I was able to watch them on the plane on my way back here to New England. And it's something that I'm passionate about. And that's going to be the bread and butter of the show today. I'll have a couple, I have a Bruins thought at the end. And I also have a thought, as I said, on travel and fan bases and what I noticed while I was gone. But where I want to begin is I want to begin with the Patriots documentary, also known as The Dynasty, also known as the Apple TV Patriots show, or whatever you want to call it. For those of you watching on YouTube, bear with me. Listening on audio, bear with me. And those of you watching on YouTube will understand that I am pulling out this book from behind me. All right, this book was written in, I believe, 2020. By Jeff Benedict, as you can see if you're watching the video feed. It's a phenomenal book. It is all about the Patriots dynasty, as the cover and the title, provide as an obvious point. It's not the only book written about the Patriots dynasty. I've read It's Better to Be Feared by Seth Wickersham. I know you're not supposed to say that Seth Wickersham is a good writer around here, but he is. That was another great book. And I've also read This Is Our City by Tony Maserati, another unpopular sports voice these days, but certainly a great, you cannot say that Wickersham and Maz aren't good writers. If you can criticize a lot them, I guess, for their opinions that you probably disagree with, but you can't say they're not good writers. And I've also read, the Belichick book by Ian O'Connor. And then there's another book, I forget, Casey Sheridan, I want to say, wrote a book called 12, which is all about Brady and sort of his story. So you might be asking, what is the point of Will going through his library here? The point is that of all the books I read about the Patriots dynasty, the one aptly named The Dynasty was the best. It was the best book. And in fact, it's the book that serves as the inspiration for this Apple TV documentary. So I'm thinking this is the best book that I've read in the few short years since the dynasty ended about the Patriots run, and it's going to be the one that's turned into a movie. Awesome. I look forward to watching this documentary. I also pointed out back in December that you can compare every sports documentary to The Last Dance, but that's not fair because they didn't have streaming in 1999. There wasn't a huge appetite for on-demand television back then unless you were trying to watch The Sopranos or whatever. But this is what you get in the modern age. The dynasty is only a few years old. This book is only a few years old. It immediately gets made into a film. And so therefore, it will never have the same impact as The Last Dance because of the time in between. But you can still enjoy this documentary. That's what I thought. That's what I thought through the first few episodes. I will also admit that, and for those of you who haven't watched it, I'm not going to give away any big spoilers, I don't think. A lot of it's history, so if you're a Patriots fan, you were interested in watching it, you probably knew a lot of what's going on anyway. The more pertinent thing is how they're covering it. So I will say, the opening sequence, the montage, the everything, was electric. I had never seen that at the beginning of a documentary. The first 3 minutes where they went through sort of a montage of 2001 all the way to 2020, it was awesome. I loved it. First episode was also great, talking about the backstory, the Drew Bledsoe injury, you know, the Belichick's rise and sort of the decision he had to make and how his Cleveland years weighed on him. Great stuff. Second episode, also awesome. All about the Tuck Rule game, which my parents attended. Fantastic TV right there. But episode three, it started to get a little bit hazy. And the reason why is they started episode one with sort of this overarching theme about the dynasty and whatnot. And then they tied back to it at the end of the third episode. But the problem is they spend almost three full episodes on the 2001 season. So they spent three full episodes on the 2001 season. Here's why that's a problem. To my knowledge, it's a 10-part documentary. They won six Super Bowls. They went to nine. The dynasty lasted 20 years. They spent three episodes, and by the end of the third episode, which we'll get to in a second, you did see three Super Bowl wins over those three episodes, but they spent almost three full episodes leading up to the win over the Rams in 2001. To put that in perspective with the book, I believe you get to the Rams Super Bowl at, I want to say, page two something, but I think it's page 219 in the book is when, so it is following the book in that regard, but this is where it started to get weird, because in episode three, they kind of ran back in history and they talked about when Kraft bought the team and the Parcells thing, which really should have been in episode one. And then on top of it, you know, you're getting all this backstory that you should have really got in episode one, because the Kraft, how he bought the team, how he came to, you know, get the stadium rights and all that stuff happens in the first like 200 pages of this book. It does not happen in place of the two Super Bowl wins that happened in 03, 04. That's my big gripe with episode three, is that you get to the first Super Bowl win and you're like 40 minutes in the episode and there's 11 minutes left, and somehow they squeeze three full seasons into 11 minutes. And you miss what the Patriots actually did to become a dynasty. Now, I might be providing spoilers. I still think you should watch this. By no means am I saying it's not worth the watch. It's still good TV in terms of the interviews and the cinematography and all that stuff. But I am just wondering how you can tell a story about the dynasty, considering Jeff Benedict gets into this. He does. Seth Wickersham talks about it in his book. In The Man in the Arena, they spent two full episodes on those two Super Bowl runs. So it's not like it hasn't been covered, but if you're going to name a documentary called The Dynasty and the two Super Bowls that back-to-back in 03 and 04 that made the Patriots a dynasty is basically summed up in 6.5 minutes because you're rushing to get to the Spygate episode, then I don't really know what you're doing, and a lot gets left on the cut floor. Right, I'm sure it was all cut, but I think when the final cut was made, decisions on what was going to be included in the documentary were made, I think the creators of the documentary were a little more interested in sort of the Palace Q drama that you might find on Felgard Maz or in Seth Wickersham's book specifically, rather than what Jeff Benedict spent years writing out. For example, in 2003, the most interesting thing of that whole season, and I've talked about this before, is that they began the year losing 31-0 to Buffalo after missing the playoffs the year before. And it was that time in which a lot of people were questioning whether New England liked their coach, whether Belichick should really be there, whether 2001 was a fluke, whether Tom Brady really should have been chosen as the guy. All these questions were being asked after that 31-0 loss to Buffalo. They also started 2-2 that season, but what they did after that was they won 21 consecutive regular season games, including a Super Bowl over Carolina that was highly regarded as one of the best Super Bowls ever, only to then lose and have that 21-game winning streak snapped on Halloween of 2004 by the Pittsburgh Steelers, who then the Patriots went on to beat on the road in the AFC title game that year in order to win a second consecutive Super Bowl over Philadelphia and win 3 out of 4, something that still hasn't been done since. The Chiefs won 3 out of 5. You know, when they get their documentary made, I guarantee they'll talk about all 3 of those Super Bowls. So that's just, especially the last one. So that's just my number one gripe so far with the documentary is you haven't covered the best parts of the dynasty, the early years of it, were, in my opinion, 2001's great. Everyone loves 2001, the sexy story with the snowball and the Drew Bledsoe decision and the Rams and the greatest show on turf and 9/11 and, you know, U2 and all that stuff. Great, great TV. I love it. 2003 and 2004 were what made this documentary exist in the first place. Because had they not won those 2 Super Bowls, Bill Belichick's probably out of town. Tom Brady is a backup somewhere for, you know, Chad Pennington or, you know, Dante Culpepper or some other, just another guy from those years. Instead, though, they win those 2 Super Bowls. It propels them to national prominence, and it makes things like Spygate an actual story. If the Patriots had cheated, quote-unquote, in 2007 with Spygate and hadn't won the 2 Super Bowls, nobody would have given a crap. What them winning made this thing relevant, made all the other episodes after relevant. Because without those 2 Super Bowls, it's a joke. But instead, the documentarians were more interested in telling the Spygate story and using the last 10 minutes to lead up to episode 4 than they were the 2 Super Bowl wins. I don't want to give too many spoilers away outside of the history. And I, you know, I don't want to talk about in particular interviews and whatnot or anything like that, because or stories, because I want you to watch that in the film. But I'll just point out that squeezing 2 Super Bowl wins into like a 6 to 9 minute span is a disservice, I think, to the story and to what Benedict wrote and to the spirit of what the documentary is supposed to be. And my biggest fear is that they're going to use that extra time, episodes away, and that we'll find out in a few weeks, to just, if they're already in episode 4 talking about the perfect season, that means that they're going to spend a lot of time talking about Aaron Hernandez, Deflategate, Wickersham's drama from 2017, the Alex Guerrero stuff, all of that debacle. And if that's what the book, if that's what the documentary is about, that's fine. But then don't call it the dynasty, because it's not really about the dynasty if you're not telling the story of 2 Super Bowl wins that in fact made this team a dynasty. That's my big gripe. You know, we're going to get an episode and a half probably on Deflategate, but we're not going to get more than 7 minutes on the, still in my opinion, the best 2-year run that any football team has had in the history of the NFL. Winning 21 consecutive regular season games, getting blown out at home to start 2003, only to beat the Bills in the last game of the year by the same score, winning those games, like I said, in a row, beating Peyton Manning twice in the playoffs to win 2 Super Bowls. You know, we haven't even, the only time I heard Peyton Manning's name during the first 4 episodes was when they talked about the 2006 season ending at the beginning of episode 4. leading up to the Spygate storyline. They didn't even talk one iota about the 2006 season and how Brady dragged a bunch of scrubs to the AFC championship game, or how they beat San Diego on the road and had all that drama that involved. Like the 2006 season, 2005 season, I think you saw the Champ Bailey interception, which they implied was returned for a touchdown. It wasn't. Ben Watson, I believe, tackled him at the one, or something like that. Maybe it was a touchdown. I don't know. I was 9 years old. But my point is that they spent all this time leading up to Deflategate in episode four, leading up to Spygate in episode four. And as a result, we lost a lot of time there. So that's frustrating. As for episode four, I just watched it. I like it. I think it's well done. I do think it tells the Spygate story in sort of a sensationalized way. I don't want to give too much away, but they talk to a cop from New Jersey as if this was some big, you know, crime. It's laughable. But beyond that, I do think the episode was well done. I like the inclusion of McDaniels and Moss. I don't want to give too much away, so I'll leave it there. But it's a good episode. The perfect season. It sucks. Every time I watch the Tyree catch, I feel like a few years of my life are just coming back to me in a way that I don't want to remember. Like, I don't want to remember being 12 years old, 11 years old, however old I was, and watching that game. I can only imagine how depressing it's going to be when we get to the second Super Bowl loss of the Giants, because that one was equally, in my opinion, as sad. But look, this is the cost, right? This is the cost of having all this run, is that when you relive it, there can be things that you like, dislike, that bring back joy and that bring back pain. I do like the documentary so far. I encourage you to watch it, even though there are some things that I believe were left out. It's still a worthwhile endeavor by Apple TV. I will also say that the Benedict book is very friendly to the crafts. And I believe that so is this documentary. I think that's on purpose. I am concerned with the Patriots' legacy now in some respects. Perhaps that's a story for another day. I was hoping this documentary would sort of be a Pat's love fest, but that's more or less what Man in the Arena was, whereas this is very much concerned, as Seth's book is too, on the Palace Q drama of the late 2010s and or the cheating scandals of 2015 and 2007, rather than it is the actual success of the team and what made this team a dynasty. Lastly, there are some great interviews in there. I don't want to give them away. You know, Mike Martz, that's a great one. There's another great interview with Lawyer Malloy and the roommate of Tom Brady. So certainly recommend that you watch, get a free trial of Apple TV when it's all out, watch it. But I guess we'll recap the next batch of episodes when it happens. As I said, I watched this on an airplane, which leads me to my travel observations. I'll just be frank. I don't fly a lot. I can't afford to fly a lot. I just can't. So, you know, I'm blessed to have, you know, family and friends that I'm able to travel with, and, you know, that are the reason for a lot of my vacations. But I just don't fly a lot. So this is still something that's a novelty to me. For those of you who fly in an airplane frequently, either for work or leisure, then you're probably like, who the hell cares about your travel observations? But I'd take a bet that most of you are like me. You fly probably once a year at most, maybe twice a year if, you know, things are happening or there's a random occurrence that leads to that. But in most cases, we don't fly often in my household. And as a result, when we do fly, I notice things. And I've said this a lot. we're in an election year. I'm not going to get into politics. But if there was a presidential candidate who came out and they said it is now a federal law that if you have a carry-on item stored in the overhead compartment, that you have to wait until people who don't have one of those get off before you can get off, I would vote for that person. To reiterate, if I don't have a overhead bin storage bag, I should be able to get off the airplane before somebody who does. If you have one of those things stored up there and it's been moved around because you boarded late, or it's been moved around because they never have enough room for any of this crap, or you don't know where it is and you forgot, or you're just slow, you should stay seated until those of us who simply want to walk off the airplane with nothing in our hands, who have checked our bags, who paid the extra $25, $50, whatever it is, to check our bags, we want to get off first. We don't have to wait around while you do a little, you know, tiddlywink dance to figure out where your bag is. Oh, do I have my charger? No, we've had 30 minutes from the descent. You should figure out what the hell you're doing, and we should be able to get off the plane first. We don't have the patience, at least I don't, to deal with people who have to stand there, shuffle around, figure out where their thing is. Oh, it's stuck. I can't get it out. Oh, it's too heavy. Oh, it's going to hit some baby in the head. You know, all that crap. I have no patience for it. So if somebody comes out and they says, I'm going to make it a federal law, if you stow something in the overhead compartment that you're staying seated until the people who haven't have got off, I would vote for that person in a heartbeat. No questions asked. That's my big gripe. That's always my gripe. And I flew Southwest this time, which, you know, Portland has a lot of Southwest flights. Flew via Thurgood Marshall down in Baltimore. Good. It was fine. Southwest is fine. They do the weird thing where there's no assigned seating. Instead, you just sort of board. And then, you know, if you board first, you seat first. I liked that. Rewards proactivity. If you want to pay the extra to have the priority boarding and get further up the line, you know, I'm a believer in capitalism. That's fine. You know, I just cannot deal with the people who stand there and clog up the line because they have no clue what they're doing. Meanwhile, the rest of us are trying to get a connection. So I think I said that the last time I got back from break, but I like to just point these things out. Second travel observation is sports related. I noticed three particular sports fan bases are everywhere. First one is the Atlanta Braves. Maybe it's just because the region in which I was traveling, I was in Florida, Southeast. A lot of Braves fans. A lot of 2021 World Series champion merch I saw on a lot of people's heads. A lot of the script A's, a lot of Braves merch. They seem like they're America's baseball team. I saw a few Yankee things, a few Dodger stuff, but I do think the Atlanta Braves are America's baseball team as a result of this anecdotal experiment. They are everywhere. The second fan base that I saw everywhere was basically anything with Leo Messi on it. It was usually an Inter Miami shirt or a Argentina international football shirt, but especially kids under the age of like 20 love Messi. He's everywhere. Again, I was in Florida. He plays for Inter Miami. Maybe that had something to do with it. I know a lot of, you know, Hispanic Americans, Latin Americans down where I was tend to like soccer more. There might be Argentinians. That could be anecdotal. They could be data driven. I don't know. My point is, Bessie is everywhere, and it's really common among kids. In fact, there was a kid wearing a full Messi kit, socks, shorts, jersey, for Inter Miami. So, I mean, and I went to Disney Springs. I was on a cruise. I was at airports. Didn't matter. They're everywhere. More radically, though, is Buffalo Bills fans are everywhere. Everywhere. It's going to make Steeler fans, Cowboy fans, Eagles fans, Pats fans, Broncos fans, anybody, Niner fans, anyone else who claims to think that they have a national fan base, or that their fan base travels, pretty upset. And again, this could be anecdotal because a lot of people from the Northeast traveled to the Southeast during this time of year. But Bills fans, no matter what airport I was in, no matter where I was, no matter what, I was on buses, I was on boats, I was on trains, I was on planes, they all had, everybody had Buffalo Bills gear. The Bills, they travel and they talk to one another. They see you. I witnessed several Bills fans walking by other Bills fans yelling out, "Go Bills." The Buffalo Bills are everywhere. They're everywhere, but the Super Bowl Champions Club. That's where I'll put, that's where I will end that one. All right, my third observation is that seating safety on airplanes is a joke. Yesterday, I was flying back to Portland from Baltimore. I had been up since 4 a.m. I was exhausted. Singing in between my father-in-law and my wife, I was about to sleep. I was about to fall asleep. We're sitting on the tarmac at BWI. I'm ready to go home. It's the final flight. I'm leaning back a little bit. My eyes are closed. We're still taxiing around. Actually, I don't even think we'd left the gate yet. A flight attendant comes up to me. Now, look, it's not their fault. They're supposed to, you know, they have bosses that mandate these things. And, you know, they're just trying to do their job. You know, I respect the profession because they're doing something that I would never do. That's my litmus test for respecting a profession. I would never be a nurse. I would never be a flight attendant. I would never be a, you know, guy who works at the transfer station. Not because I think I'm better than that, but because I don't think I would be good at that job. I don't think I would be a good flight attendant. I don't think I would be a good, I don't know, transfer station worker. And I don't think I would be a good nurse. That's not because I look down at it. I just know that I wouldn't be good in that role. So this is nothing against the flight attendant. I just cannot explain to you without laughing what happened. So I'll try not to. I lean back. I'm sleeping. She comes up to me. She says, you need to move your seat forward. Granted, my seat had moved a grand total of, I think, an inch and a quarter back from its original, space. And it was sort of, there's certain give to airplane seats and then there's not, right? So I'm leaning back. Okay, I'll bring forward. But the chair won't go forward, all right? It's stuck backward. So she says, so she walks by and then she walks by again and she says, "Sir, I need you to lean your chair forward." And again, it's gone back an inch and a quarter. It's not parallel with, you know, my wife's or my father-in-law's, but it's leaned back a little bit. I said, okay. I yarded on it a little bit to try and move it forward and it slid back into position. And she says, "I need you to do it." And I politely looked and I said, "I'm trying to do that." And then she reached out and felt it and realized that it was broken and said, "Oh, it's okay. Some of them are broken." All right. So it's so important that it needs to be fixed that I need to fix it because I'm doing something wrong. So important that that needs to happen. But it's not important enough where it's okay that it's broken. Excuse me? Now, I know this is a really small thing to be frustrated over, but in my opinion, it goes to show that all of these things are just sort of cosmetic theater. And I'm not going to get into a big COVID rant, but it sort of reminds me a lot of masking on airplanes. Remember when masks were so important on airplanes? Until they brought by the pretzels and the Coke and the Sprite or whatever you were getting in the little cup. Then suddenly, like, it was okay to take your mask off. Because COVID would just like stop while you were eating or drinking on the airplane. That is what it reminded me of. It's so important that his seat is in the correct position until the seat is broken. Then I guess it doesn't need to be fixed. Or it's okay that it's broken. That's hilarious to me. In my opinion, like, look, these people, they're doing the best that they can. I respect them. You know, they just want to keep us safe. Like, I get it. But at some point, you have to laugh at the absurdity of some of these things. It was completely absurd. All right, my last thing is, I had it written down. All right, mentioned I was at Disney Springs. Disney Springs is retail on steroids. Anyone who tells you that retail is dead or that people, you know, aren't spending money, because of the economy or whatever. Look, I'll be the first to tell you inflation is ridiculous. But I met Disney Springs a week ago. And we didn't actually go to the Disney parks. We just went to Disney Springs, which is, for those of you who don't know, like their big mall, shopping, dining, entertainment area at Disney World. There were people everywhere. Now, granted, it was raining, so maybe a lot of people weren't at the theme parks. But the stores were packed shoulder to shoulder, every store. Didn't matter if it was a Disney-themed store or not. Stores were packed. The restaurants were packed. The walkways were packed. People were everywhere. People were spending money. And people were spending money on things such as a $45 mouse ears headband, a $35 baseball cap that simply said Disney Springs. It was like, it wasn't even like themed for, you know, cars or Finding Nemo or anything like that. Like, it was just literally Disney Springs baseball cap. They had like dozens of restaurant options. People, you know, spending ungodly amounts on food. And it just made me think that no matter how bad the economy is, people are willing to still go to retail when they're on vacation. Like, you know, people will check their economic and personal finance skills at the door when they're on vacation. And for better or for worse, that's not, I'll leave that up to you. But the amount of things that I saw people buying and the amount of options of things to buy, the amount of places that you could eat, the amount of different stores that you could have, I had never seen anything like it in my life. And I've been to some of the biggest malls in the world. You know, when I was a kid, I went to the West Edmonton Mall in Edmonton, Alberta. At the time, I think it was maybe a top two or three mall in the world in terms of size. And this was when anchor stores and before really the big Amazon push and all that. And it was huge. It was massive. It had a water park, it had casinos, it had hotels, it had roller coasters, all that stuff. Disney Springs was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. So the next time someone tells you that retail is dead, just remind them that the entire state at the southeast coast of our country is nothing but retail. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Home Field Advantage. Hope you all had a great time listening. Sorry for my rants. Hope you found it entertaining, to be honest. If you put me in charge, I think I could fix the airlines, but we'll leave that for another day. We'll be back next week. We'll be talking some hockey with Kyle Diesel. I do want to touch quickly on the Bruins. They need to get their you-know-what together. It's getting a little scary, all these overtime games that they've been losing. I think they've lost something like 9 in the last like 5 weeks. They've lost like 9 overtime games or something crazy like that. Maybe like 8 or 9 overtime games. It's starting to get worrisome. So we'll talk about that with Kyle next week. We'll talk about the Devils. We'll talk about all the rest of the teams in the AHL too. I also want to talk about MLB expansion with him, see if we can squeeze that in, even though it's a hockey-centric episode. So we have all that to look forward to on the next episode of Home Field Advantage or on Man Rush. I'd appreciate it if you subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts or follow us on social at Home Field Pod. But until next time, my name is Will Island. You've been listening to Home Field Advantage. If you liked this podcast, please subscribe on your favorite provider, including Spotify, Apple, Google, and Stitcher. Be sure to also check us out 2 times a week on those platforms, on Monday and on Thursday. All of the Sportland USA programs are independent, and the opinions expressed in them do not reflect those of any other company, outlet, person, or entity.